Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Haiti has yet again suffered a major political crisis and an earthquake. But is the humanitarian and economic aid coming from abroad helping or harming the Haitian people? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Haiti is one of the poorest nations in the world. But what are the causes of this poverty? International aid has flowed into the nation, in particular throughout the last 2 to 3 decades. It's been the target of international military intervention and humanitarian aid resulting from political as well as economic and environmental crises. And this year, it suffered the dual crisis of the assassination of its president and yet another devastating earthquake. But the aid not only hasn't helped, but it has created a dependency economy and a dual political structure, power structure, that has exacerbated endemic poverty and economic and political marginalization. On today's show, we will explore the causes of Haiti's poverty, of its marginalization, and the perverse effects of the aid economy. Our guests are Jean-Eddy St. Paul, professor in the Department of Sociology and founding director of the City University of New York, or CUNY's, Haitian Studies Institute. He's the author of Assassinations and Invasions, How the U.S. and France Shaped Haiti's Long History of Political Turmoil. Anthony Bokes, Asa Messer Professor of Humanities and Critical Theory, Professor of Africana Studies, and Director of the Center of the Study of Slavery and Justice at Brown University. He is the author of Empire of Liberty, Power, Freedom, and Desire. And later in the show, we will be joined by Mark Schuller, Professor of Anthropology and Nonprofit and NGO Studies at Northern Illinois University. He's the author of Humanitarian Aftershocks in Haiti. Jean-Eddy, let me ask you the first question. The history of Haiti is one that's been marked by international interventions of indebtedness and of political and economic marginalization. Why has Haiti been so marginalized?
Doug, very nice to be on this show and with Anthony. So it's my great pleasure. Let's start by saying that when you introduced in your introduction that you stress on the idea that Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. So I would say first, in order to understand the current crisis in Haiti, we have also to, you know, correct certain concepts that we are using. For instance, I would say that Haiti is a country that has been impoverished, but it's not really a poor country because there are different measurements of poverty. A country cannot be poor if that country has a bunch of natural resources, as is the case for Haiti. So the current political crisis in Haiti has, you know, some structural cause that we should explore. And of course, something that has to deal with the conjuncture, right? But if we want to know about the structural cause that have led to the current crisis in Haiti, we have some external factors and some internal factors that we should explore. For instance, in Haiti, we do not have functional elites. We have what we call in political science the most repugnant elites, because Haiti, since the assassination of the founding father, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, there has been a disconnection between the political elites and the masses of the Haitian population. So this is one thing, one internal factor, but also there are certain external factors. For instance, because of the ontology and the character of the philosophical character of the Haitian Revolution, because in Western modernity, if we do like in political science, what we call comparative politics, when we compare the Haitian Revolution to the French Revolution or the American Revolution, epistemologically, the Haitian Revolution is the most advanced revolution that we never had in the Western modernity. But because the Haitian Revolution was the unique anti-slavery revolution, and Haiti was born in the context of globalization, because globalization as an epiphenomenon of modernity, globalization didn't start in 1964, although it was in 1964 that the Webster Dictionary gave an entry to the concept of globalization. But globalization is an epiphenomenon of modernity. And when Haiti got its independence in January 1st, 1804, we were dealing with in a global village. And back at that time, the international community never accept Haiti as a sister country, even though despite the fact that the trilogy of the French Revolution was liberty, égalité, fraternity, for liberty, equality, and fraternity, but the other nation never accepted, you know, other powerful nation, they never accepted Haiti, you know, as a sister nation. So they isolate Haiti since the very beginning. And it, from 1825, Haitian had to pay $150,000 to French government in order to get the recognition of its independence. The United States of America was one of the last country to recognize the Haitian independence. And then also another internal factor that can help us to understand the structural roots of Haiti current predicament has to deal also that in the fact that Haiti's economy is not managed by the black skin Haiti, because in Haiti, we have more than 99% of the population that is black skin. But Haiti is a country in which black people, they are living as foreigner and outsider in their own land, because the economy of Haiti is captured by an oligarchy that is made of Arab people, you know, light-skinned people. This is all those factors, internal and external factors, that we have to combine all together. And finally, we cannot, you know, not incorporate, you know, the foreign policy of the international community, and more specifically, the U.S. foreign policy towards Haiti. Because U.S., in the context of the Monroe Doctrine, the U.S. occupy Haiti, the U.S. Navy occupy Haiti for 19 years. During those 19 years, you know, they changed the Haitian constitution. They introduced a clause that allowed, for instance, foreigners to own land in Haiti. And that in the that invasion and occupation also contribute to the process of undermining Haiti sovereignty. On top of that, also, during the 19 years of that U.S. occupation, they took the money from the National Bank of Haiti, and that money was transferred to the National City Bank. So throughout the 20th century, you will have in the context of the Cold War, for instance, the U.S. backed up, you know, the most brutal dictatorship in Haiti, the dictatorship of the Duvalier, from 1957 to 1986. And then in the context of, you know, as you know, when, for instance, when Samuel Huntington published his book, The Third Wave of Democratization, you know, after what happened with Portugal, you know, you will see that in Latin America and Southeast Asia, you know, many of those countries will enter into a phase of political transition. So Haiti entered in that political transition in January 7, 1986. But in that political transition, the U.S. never gave Haitian people the chance to put decent politicians to run the country. We have always had interference, you know, U.S. meddling into Haitian politics. So in closing, we can say the current crisis of Haiti obey to a combination of internal factors and external factors.
Anthony Bogues, the description that we have is fairly well known. It's almost ironic to me in that Haiti gained its independence before nearly any other country in the Western Hemisphere, obviously slightly after the U.S., before most of what we call Latin America. Yet it's a country that traditionally has been one of the least independent. Frequently, it gets described that Haiti's political and economic underdevelopment is because the world has ignored Haiti. But the image that we're getting here is it definitely has not ignored Haiti. There has been tremendous international influence in the country throughout its history. Is that correct? And is that really kind of at the core of sort of Haiti's challenges with underdevelopment?
Thank you very much for inviting me to be on this radio show. There are several things that I would want to say that I think are important. One, I think in your framing argument, one of the questions that we have to ask is a general question. If you could show me a country in the so-called, let me call it third world, just for the time being, where aid has actually helped that country to, quote unquote, and I put this in, you know, a lot of quotes, to develop, then okay, we have an argument. But part of the way in which aid has been structured from industrialized countries, whether it's Europe or the United States, has never been about the actual, quote unquote, development of the other country receiving the aid. The structures of aid has always been about how does it help the country that is sending the aid. So I think that there's a kind of a misconception about aid in a way where if I give you a lot of money, if I give you a lot of stuff, then quote unquote, you are supposed to develop without thinking about the actual structure of aid, how much is given, how much is taken out, and also who benefits, quite frankly. Because if you go to Haiti, there are more NGOs per square mile than any other place that I know of. But if you look at the ways in which some of the NGO practitioners live and how, in fact, they relate to the rest of the population, then it is actually, quite frankly, not all of them, but a significant number of them are living a life of what we call a life of Riley. But they are in Haiti, and it is seen as like it's a so-called hardship post, but it's a hardship post in which, in fact, you benefit from individually when you go. So I want to, not everybody, please, not all, because I know some really fine people who've gone to Haiti who have and fell in love with the place and who have stayed there and who are doing good work. But I want to talk about, I think it's important to think about the structure of aid generally, and particularly post-1945 in the world. So it's not just Haiti, and to see how aid, in fact, is not an instrument of quote-unquote development. And I put that in another quotation mark. The second point I would want to make is to build on what my colleague just said, you know, to ask people to think of a situation where you have gained your political independence in, you know, 1804, 1805. And by 1825, 20 years after you have gained your political independence, the people who colonized you and who held you in slavery turn to you and say, you need to pay us in present day money $21 billion. For recognition. And what does that mean? Because that means you have to take money out of your budget once you agree. So for nearly, you know, 1825 and the 1930s, Haiti had to pay that. One of my arguments is that, quite frankly, that helped to bankrupt the treasury of Haiti. One has to think about, but it's not just bankrupting the treasury, is that if you think about Haiti as the symbol of Black sovereignty, in the 19th century, only symbol of Black sovereignty in the world, right before the colonization of Africa and the Berlin Conference in the 1870s, then what you have to realize is that powers that be could not allow Haiti to survive. And I think this is important. So it's not just, it's external intervention, and then I come to the internal in a minute, but it is also an active kind of intervention that says, this cannot survive. This cannot survive because it is an example of Black sovereignty is anathema to racial slavery, which is happening in America, and colonialism in the world. One of the things that always strikes me is a letter that Napoleon you know, wrote to the British ambassador, in which he says that we have to deal with Saint-Domingue. He's, and I'm paraphrasing him here, not just because of we have to get the revolt under control, not just because of commerce, he says. And this is, I'm quoting him here directly. He says, we have to deal with the specter of the blacks. And it is the specter of the blacks and black sovereignty that I think Haiti has been made to pay it for. So it's not that we kind of think in neutral terms and so on, without seeing that actual global politics is actually an active force. And the active force is what? Is that Haiti must pay for being the first Black Republic. The other point that I would want to make is that that external situation which Haiti faced has been the first Black Republic and trying to mount a defense of Black sovereignty. That becomes really very important in thinking about the internal political apparatus of Haiti and the evolution. I agree with my colleague, the assassination of Dessalines opened up a different space inside Haiti. But what also I think became very clear, and Michel Ravchulio and others have written about this, is that there is a way in which once the militarization, for good reasons, in my view, takes place inside Haiti, then there is a formation of a certain kind of elite. And as the formation of that elite means that the actual internal structures of the state does not begin to represent the aspirations of the ordinary persons. And so by the 1850s and 60s, you are getting, you know, revolts that are talking about, you know, what kind of free is this and so on. But what to me is significant is that you then begin to get a state in which there is no national project, and it can't be a national project over a period because the elites and the population are actually separate. And so you get what Julio calls nation versus state. And so I think all those kind of things, the external factor, which my colleague so eloquently spoke about, as well as the internal things, factors, creates a situation, and I'm glad he said that, not that way Haiti is poor, but that way Haiti is impoverished, because the impoverishment is the cause of something. And what we need to think about is what are the active forces that create that impoverishment? Because the mass of the Haitian people many times have tried to actually get out of their impoverishment. And one of the things that we might want to think about is why they have not been able to do that.
That's a great question. You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the ongoing crises and marginalization in Haiti with Jean-Eddy St. Paul of City University of New York, Anthony Bogues of Brown University, and Mark Schuller of Northern Illinois University. Jean-Eddy, you had a response.
I just wanted to add to what Professor Bogues just says. For instance, regarding the structure of aid in Haiti, since I know that many of your students might listen to us too, it's very important. There is a book that was published in 2017. The title of this book is Who Owns Haiti? People, Power, and Sovereignty. And the book was edited by Professor Brian Freeman and other professors. So in this book, they explain, for instance, if you analyze what happened to Haiti after the 2010 earthquake, so you have a bunch of NGOs, but many of those NGOs have their headquarters in Washington, D.C., and you have more than 98% of the, money fundraised on behalf of Haiti. And back at that time, the former president, William Jefferson, a.k.a. Bill Clinton, was, you know, the one of the guys who overviewed, you know, the reconstruction of Haiti under the slogan, Build Haiti Back and Better. But you have 90% of that money returned to those NGOs based in Washington, D.C. So it's just to complement, to add to what Anthony said, you know, when we are talking about aid in Haiti, So Ed in the third world, quote unquote. So Ed would never develop the third, world country. For instance, we just had in August 14, 2021, a new earthquake that hit Haiti, that hit the south of Haiti, Lekai, Nip, and Grandance. But for instance, according to the research I was collecting, on August 21st, let's say 1 week after the quake, the United Nations so initially said that they will give 8 million to Haiti through their Central Emergency Response Fund, but only UN, United Nations agencies such as World Food Program and the Commission for Refugee and UNICEF will get that money. You can see it's very tricky when you see a lot of money, going to Haiti, but that money never reach the hand of the Haitian government, the state agent. So you have, United Nations agency who actually got access to that money, and their interest is never the same interest. They don't have the same interest as the Haitian civil society or the Haitian government. For instance, they never will go and help to strengthen the civil society because, when we are talking about the building process of citizenship, it's not only the state, but the civil society should be a very important actor. But through those, UN agency, they marginalize the government, they marginalize the local grassroots. So that money returned to the so-called, the global north. So yeah, this is what I just want to add.
And Anthony, John Eddy just highlighted this, something that I know I've become familiar with, is kind of the different types of aid being delivered, different types of NGOs, some doing a better job of integrating with the local population. But one of the consistent complaints is, again, aid has tended to flow into the country, but everyday Haitians so seldom receive the aid. And instead, it becomes a means by which that wealthy nations can make more money off of Haiti.
I would think so. And I would think, I come from Jamaica, and, it's a set of practices that you have, USAID and so on and so forth, is a set of practices in which, you can only do certain things. You are restricted, and you can only buy certain things from certain places. So in a lot of ways, for example, aid becomes a way in which the so-called donor country reaps a certain amount of profit, because there are certain restrictions around that, around what you can do with the aid and so on. So, my colleague is right. So by the time you finish deal with all the restrictions, 90% goes back to the donor country. If you can only buy this truck here, or if you can only buy this flower here, if you can only buy this through that, and, through this particular donor country. So the aid becomes, quite frankly, an aid back to the donor countries.
Just to sort of follow up so I can understand this, is frequently what the challenge here is that aid is given, it's given to different groups within Haiti, but they can only use that aid to purchase goods from the country that's providing the aid. I know that that's been a model.
That is still the model. As far as I understand it, that's still the model.
And here is very important. I am glad that you guys brought this topic on the table, because for instance, the first time I traveled abroad, I left Haiti, I was 29 years old. So I live in Haiti, I attend school, I attend college in Haiti. So I live in the country. In the 1980s, let me tell you, I was born in the countryside of Haiti. And in the 1980s, Haiti was a country that had, food sufficiency. So Haitian people were able to feed themselves. For instance, my dad was, a farmer, and we had everything. So it's important now we are addressing the problem of aid, the structure of aid, but also we have to address the condition, external condition that were created in order to make Haiti very dependent of external aid. And we cannot do that without addressing a tour of critique to neoliberalization, to neoliberal austerity. For instance, in 1983, 1985, then president of the US, Ronald Reagan, he launched the CBI, the Caribbean Basin Initiative. So they destroy, for instance, the local pork in Haiti. They said that they had disease, they call that first porcine African, and they kill, you know, the Creole pork in Haiti. And the Creole pork was a very important source of, you know, income for the people, for Haitian people, and more specifically for the peasants. So, and then also they undermine the rice production in Haiti. So they will start the process of neoliberalization to put pressure on Haitian politicians to open, for instance, Haiti to goods and everything coming from the US, from Canada, etc. But it was a time Haiti was self-sufficient. Back in the beginning of the 1980s, Haiti didn't have to buy, you know, rice from the U.S. and everything from the Dominican Republic. And recently, some years ago, Professor Robert Fatton Jr., who is a professor of political science at the University of Virginia, he published a very interesting book I really recommend. It's titled The Outer Periphery, in which Robert Fatton, he used the theory, you know, of the center dependency, the theory of the school of dependency, to explain that Haiti is not only now located at the periphery of the global north, but Haiti also is a periphery of the Dominican Republic. For instance, in Haiti, we used to have self-sufficiency in terms of, you know, bananas, you know, plantain. Now Haiti has to buy those things from the Dominican Republic, lemon, everything, a lot of things that we used to produce in Haiti. Now we are getting those things, you know, of less quality from the Dominican Republic. So neoliberalization has, you know, highly negatively affected, for instance, Haiti's stability and Haiti economic development. For instance, in December 16, 1990, in the world history of Haiti, it was the first time Haitian people got a chance to elect by themselves the person they wanted to be, you know, their leader. It was the Catholic priest, a former Salesian priest named Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was, you know, a very prominent leader of liberation theology. But back at that time, in 1990, although the political speech, you know, the intellectual discourse work, we are in the face of democratization, etc., quality of democracy were those concepts that in Western academy we were using. But at the same time, we were talking about democratization, democracy, strengthening civil society, the quality of democracy, you know, accountability. But because Jean-Bertrand Aristide was anti-neoliberal austerity, he was anti, you know, the fact that the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, will do whatever they want to in Haiti. So he was against those kind of neoliberal, you know, organization. So, but the international community, the U.S. through the CIA, they work with the hierarchy of the army, an army that was also a legacy of the first U.S. occupation of Haiti. And they overthrown Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And after Jean-Bertrand Aristide, you will see more and more implementation of neoliberal policies in Haiti that will undermine and weaken more and more the Haitian state and its capacity, you know, to serve as what, you know, Thomas Hobbes will call a Leviathan. Because now the state is like an illusion. The state doesn't exist in Haiti. Now you have gangsterization all over. You have, for instance, kidnapping. But in Haiti, we do not manufacture guns. You see, so it's a very complicated situation, but you can see the hand of the international community in undermining the structure, those institutions, because the state doesn't exist. The state is a fiction. The state is an illusion. The state will exist based on the representation of men and women, you know, working with commitment, ethics of responsibility within those institutions. But from the process of the political transition, you have external forces. For instance, in January 15, 2021, I published an article in the Georgetown Journal of International Affairs. And in that article, I use the theoretical framework of Joel S. Migdal. Joel S. Migdal explained to us that the state doesn't exist because in front of the state, you have different social forces trying to challenge the state. So the Haitian state, the people who are speaking in the name of the Haitian state, when they are good leaders, when they want to, you know, promote, you know, the good life for their own citizens, you always have external forces working with some internal forces, you know, to challenge the legitimacy of those state agents. So it's a very complex situation.
And we are now joined by Mark Schuller, who's professor of anthropology and nonprofit and NGO studies at Northern Illinois University. Mark, thank you very much for joining us. We've been discussing the history of Haiti and challenges Haiti has faced tied to their independence and the way the French had charged Haiti a bill for their independence and the way in which international interventions have undermined Haitian, particularly economic independence, as well as their political independence, creating a process of underdevelopment on the island. So I'll ask you, what do you see as really the core challenge that Haiti faces with its political and economic development and the empowerment of the Haitian people?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I'm sure my colleagues already answered much of what I would say. So I apologize if I'm repeating what my colleague said, but for sure, the challenges, the neocolonial domination that has existed and continues to exist, that racial capitalism, the role that Haiti was granted in the world economy as the source for cheap labor and for minerals and other sorts of, you know, capitalist endeavors that are extractivist. So since 1915, the U.S. has there was the U.S. occupation militarily that lasted 19 years. But since then, it's been a neocolonial relationship that is unbroken. The U.S. supported the Duvalier regime. The U.S. supported the Tonton Macoutes. The U.S. Threw out the Duvalier regime and installed the Pliant regime in 1986 to slow down the pace of social change. The U.S. Collaborated with local elite population in the military to oust the first democratically elected government. The U.S. installed a series of unelected NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and worked with institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, to keep Haiti indebted and unable to make decisions based on what the Haitian people want. So this limited sovereignty limits what Haitian people are able to demand. And the neoliberal policy and economic flows reduced the investment in social infrastructure, hollowed out the government, created a parallel state of NGOs. And so the situation that you have today reflects the policies that are largely unbroken. And so for sure, the debt that Haiti owed to France for as a condition for accepting that they lost pretty badly the Haitian Revolution is unprecedented in world history. And you know, the unbroken legacy of white supremacist understandings of Haiti and the ways in which media frames the conversation and limits our imagination of possibilities and reinforces intervention by any means necessary. These are all part and parcel of the same neocolonial project that, as Trio said, the longest neocolonial experiment in the hemisphere.
Where we are at this point now is we're speaking of economic marginalization, and economic marginalization that isn't just driven by poverty. We've made this distinction between being impoverished versus having poverty, but there seems to be some degree of design and intention on, you know, Haiti's impoverishment, the concept of underdeveloped rather than just lesser developed or undeveloped. And then, of course, what seems to immediately come to mind, and Anthony, I'll ask you this to respond first, is the political disempowerment. It seems that Haitian history has been marked by a lack of representation of the interests of the Haitian people, and the cause of that being international interventions, whether they're NGOs, elites within Haitian society, or external actors who've dominated this. And so what's the relationship between political empowerment and economic empowerment?
Doug, I don't like to use the word empowerment because it actually draws from a certain genealogy, quite frankly, of the Washington Consensus and neoliberalism. But I understand, you know, when people use it. So let me use it.
What would you, what's a better phrase than empowerment?
Well, I mean, no, I think, because I think what happens is that the question that has faced Haiti is the question of Black sovereignty and the questions of democracy. And is it possible for a country that opened up the door for Black sovereignty in a world of racial capitalism to survive? And how does it survive internally? And what are the kind of democratic forms that it needs to think about or that needs to be practiced? And one of the things that I think is clear is that within Haiti is that there has always been the external aided and abetted by internal, because to me, this is important. These questions are not just the external. Unless you have an internal elite that is willing to work and aid and abet with the external is never successful. And so the question for me, and you know, I speak from a certain kind of experience inside the Caribbean, and that if you have a situation in which you have an internal elite that has a particular hostility to the ordinary Haitian persons, where the class structure and the racial and the color structure, bear in mind that when the French ruled Haiti, they divided the Haitian society into 128 gradations of people of color. And that kind of understanding of color and eliteness and significance of color has meant that you have a particular elite that has no interest. It is not, you know, to use some of the words like a fan for Fanon, it is not even a national bourgeoisie that has any interest in anything else than to enrich itself. One can't even call it a national bourgeoisie, might. But to call it an elite and that in, to enrich itself, it means that it always has to practice a developer set of politics and a set of practices, economic practices, in which the Haitian mass of the population is marginalized. And that kind of marginalization, in my view, is deeply connected, obviously, to the external. And so you don't get any kind of economic, quote-unquote, development, and I put that in 100 quotation marks, unless you begin to be able to think about unleashing the creative energies of the ordinary Haitian people. You cannot get that unless you begin to have some form of democracy. And I'm not here just talking about representational democracy. I'm here talking about ways in which the ordinary person can feel that he or she belongs to the society, ways in which sort of economic opportunities can be given so that people can manage their own lives and so on. And so that to me, that's one of the things is missing. One of the things about the Aristide, early Aristide government, the first part of the Aristide, you know, when the Aristide came into power. And I was in Haiti for that moment, both for the inauguration, as well as because I worked then for CARICOM. We were trying to do some stuff inside working with the Aristide government, was that the policies were about trying to think about how to broaden the scope of economic activity alongside the democracy. And so that what is interesting to me is how the elites reacted to that policy from day one. Very, very quickly, they decided to position themselves to overthrow that government. From day one, from the inauguration speech, they decided this person had to go. In doing that, I mean, you know, there's Cedras and so on. It was a cabal and reorganization of a certain of the military to make sure that Aristide could not succeed, but also very importantly, to make sure that whatever space that was being created, democratic space that was being created by Lavalas and by Aristide was absolutely destroyed. My point is that that one cannot just think about questions of economics in Haiti without not thinking simultaneously about questions of democracy. And that part of the difficulty is that you have both an internal and an external set of forces that want to make sure that there is no democratic space for the ordinary Black Haitian masses.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the ongoing crises and marginalization in Haiti with Jean-Eddie St. Paul of City University of New York, Anthony Bogues of Brown University, and Mark Schuller of Northern Illinois University. Jean-Eddie, you had a response.
Yes, I would just to chime in, jump in to add to what Anthony just mentioned. For instance, my key point here, my core argument would be that we have to understand that in Haiti now, there is a clear political consciousness. For instance, in Haiti, there are many groups, certain are urban groups from the civil society, other are grassroots with certain kind of connection to the countryside of Haiti. They have a clear consciousness. So they have the name of the co-opted people. They know the roots of the problem. They know that we don't want guns in Haiti. We don't want the same U.S. foreign policy in Haiti. We don't want the continuity of the same French and Canadian foreign policy toward Haiti. Let's say in Haiti, you have many social groups that have that clear consciousness and use, for instance, the public arena, the public sphere to express, their dissatisfaction, to express, their problems against the internal actors and against also the external actors. For instance, in 2019, the U.S. Congress held a hearing on Haiti. It was during the administration of Donald John Trump. And at the beginning of the administration of Joseph Biden, the same U.S. Congress held another hearing on Haiti. And you have Haitian representative of Haitian people in the diaspora, representative of the Haitian civil society. They came, they testified. You have representative of, activists of civil rights. They came, they testified. But nothing happened from the U.S. But in Haiti, you have effectively many actors who are fighting for a better quality of democracy in Haiti. They are asking, for instance, for the U.S. to stop the flow of guns in Haiti. As I said earlier in the show, we don't manufacture guns, but 90 plus percent of the guns who are at the hand, for instance, of kidnapper now, where those guns come? From the U.S. There is a clear diagnostic. Haitian people, both in the diaspora and on the ground in Haiti, they know the source of the problems and they have the recipe, but the international community doesn't want to work with them, doesn't want to work with the grassroots, doesn't want to work with progressive force in Haiti, with people. We have leaders in Haiti. We have young leaders who have ethics of responsibility, but they are powerless in vis-a-vis certain, traditional politicians who have very great tie, strong tie with the traditional oligarchy. And so they don't have, when you say the balance of power, they have less, they cannot fight against them because they don't have guns and they don't want to use guns themselves. They want to use other, technique in order to fight, to live a dignified life. But there is a clear political consciousness in the ground in Haiti and also in the diaspora. But we don't have, a change in the political culture of the traditional actor and also from the international community. But again, there is a clear consciousness, what is the core problem that we are facing and what to do to solve the problem. The diagnostic is very clear.
And Mark Schiller, part of what we're describing here is this disconnect between the Haitian population, local Haitian leaders, and power within Haiti. And you've already referenced the fact that there seems to be at least a shadow government or an alternative form of government with the role of NGOs, in essence, running the country. So first, could you describe sort of how that works and what that cleavage then means for Black sovereignty, for Haitian sovereignty?
NGOs are invited in the country after periods of crisis. The first longest standing NGOs were invited after Hurricane Hazel back in the 1950s. And then after every successive rupture, you have punctuated, you know, in Haiti, they call it invasion of NGOs. Sylvain Pierre-Etienne, his book was called Invasion of NGOs. That's pretty clear in how local intellectuals at least understand the phenomenon. The United States engineered the transition of power that secured from Papa to Baby Doc in 1971 through a meeting with who was to become the vice president, Nelson Rockefeller. And one of the agreements was that the United States would keep dissidents out of Haiti in exchange for accepting missionary organizations. That was one of the beginnings of the NGOization of the country, what they call the Republic of NGOs. When you're talking about sovereignty, the NGO Republic of Haiti bled the sovereignty by a couple ways. One is indirect by the brain drain of the public sector through these short-term contracts that NGOs offer by offering, you know, 5, 6, sometimes 10 times the amount of money that they would be earning as a state employee. Secondly, by territorial control. These donors like USAID, the Canadian, the ACDI or CEDA, in language of the acronym, the French Alliance, these bilateral donors use NGOs headquartered in their country in large part to, you know, bypass Haitian government. And they cite reasons of the corruption that the NGOs are closer to people. But these are institutions that are headquartered in the country, and their only structural accountability is to their donors, to upward, out of the country. And so this presents a problem when these NGOs are given control to, what they say in Haiti, to cut the cake. You know, like, what part of Haiti is this NGO or that NGO going to be administering in terms of their programs? And the reward structure that was put in place basically bled any kind of ability of the Haitian government to even coordinate the activities. Before the 2010 earthquake, 10 to 20% of NGOs that were working in Haiti did the bare minimum of register with the Haitian government at the Office of NGO Coordination, or UCAONG in the original French. That number went up because of some active participation and, you know, basically publishing a list of NGOs that were officially registered. And they would send a copy to the Nouvelle Liste, Haiti's largest newspaper, to the donors like USAID and to UNICEF and UNDP, and said, if your NGOs are not on this list, you need to do something about it. So there was some will to do that. So the brain drain of the public sector combined with unaccountable structures that are basically parallel governments where NGOs don't develop capacity to do what governments can do. They're not responsible to the public. NGOs aren't given, they'll work on food security. This year, next granting cycle, they're going to be doing deforestation. Next grant cycle, they're doing maternal health. They're basically just following the money. And that's why they're considered a parallel government. That's why people call it, you know, a republic of NGOs. And that's how systematically, you know, the world's first free Black republic has that sovereignty taken away from it.
Quick follow-up then. Are most of these NGOs American NGOs, or is there quite a bit of internationalization?
The official, I mean, Bill Clinton said there was 10,000 NGOs. How he arrived at that number, we assume he was referring to a statement made by the World Bank, and they weren't talking about NGOs. They were talking about any kind of organizations that were registered with this or that ministry in the government of Haiti. So in terms of registered NGOs, it topped the list at about 800. And so if you look at the vast majority of them are headquartered in the United States, but there are French, there are Spanish, there is MST, you know, a Brazilian social movement organization that is operating in Haiti. But there are, you know, other sorts of cooperation that are south-south, but the vast majority of them are headquartered in imperialist countries like the United States, particularly the United States as the biggest hegemonic superpower that's in, quote-unquote, Haiti's backyard.
Thank you. Anthony, to kind of conclude the conversation, now that we've kind of laid out what the challenges, what the different the issues that that Haiti faces. What kind of recommendations would you make as far as for those of us who want to see Haiti succeed, want to see Haitians succeed? Where should we focus our attentions?
Let me say that I don't make recommendations, but particularly if I don't live in a country. I think it's a little arrogant. But what I would say is that those of us who reside and live in the United States, one of the things that we need to do is to say to the United States, hands off Haiti. That's as simple as that. And that it would be important to allow Haitians to develop their own democratic structures, their own set of politics, and to deal with whatever it is that they have to deal with. But the key is for those of us who live in the U.S., not to say to Haitians what you must do, but for us to say to the governments that we are in the countries we now live, hands off.
As a follow-up, are there any organizations who are doing work that are providing materials, you know, providing resources that Haitians need, but do basically take a hands-off approach? Are there...
Not as far as I know, but then I don't know every organization. Not as far as...
Mark, do you have any...
There's a campaign now to raise the minimum standards. So organizations that are collecting donations on behalf of the people in Haiti after the earthquakes are being asked to sign a pledge, basically that they will stop engaging in disaster porn, that they'll use respectful language, that they'll respect Haitian leadership, that they are being inclusive, that they're investing in Haitian capacity. And so that's taking a little while to get off the ground, but there are organizations that are willing to do better, and they know they have to do better. The Haitian community was extremely upset after the 2010 earthquake and the disaster capitalism that followed. So I, like my colleague, don't want to engage in recommendations. I think that's the imperial impulse. And so it's, the harder work is just to make sure that you're doing the work to say that we know that the structure was, the reward structure increased the inequality and encouraged corruption and waste, and we know we need to do better. The donation, the citizens or residents of places like the United States, our task is not to say what Haiti needs, but to basically get the U.S. government off the neck of the Haitian people. The last words of my first book was from a street merchant, a tea merchant, who said, you know, the best way you can help Haiti is to bring back democracy to Washington. The idea that there was something called the democracy, and just because of the social movements here in the United States, and if we let the oligarchs that rule Washington decide what foreign policy is, then we're going to keep, the problem's going to be proved to be reproduced. That as people, we have more in common with each other than are the elites that rule our governments.
Jean-Eddie, we have about 90 seconds left. I'm going to give you the last word on this question.
So I would say there are many things that we can do. For instance, what we are doing now, for instance, counter narrative on Haiti. So because it's very important, the media representation on Haiti, we have to change the media representation, the way we used to portray traditionally Haiti. But also we are living in a global village. I would say, yes, the U.S. has, you know, its feet on the Haiti's neck. But also the U.S. is one of the actors that has a huge moral responsibility on Haiti current predicament. So I would say also Haitian people should do something. For instance, many of the gang leaders, they have strong connection in the U.S. Some might say they are on the paycheck, you know, of the CIA. So the U.S. also can help to take the guns off the street of Haiti, to dismantle the gun. Let's do this first, and then give Haitian people the opportunity, the civil society can work with political actors so they can figure out their own solution.
Thank you all very much. We've been discussing the ongoing economic and political crises in Haiti, international interventions, and pathways for the empowerment, not empowerment, Black sovereignty of Haitians. Our guests have been Jean-Eddie St. Paul, professor in the Department of Sociology and founding director of the City University of New York, or CUNY, Haitian Studies Institute. He is the author of Assassinations and Invasions, How the U.S. and France Shaped Haiti's Long History of Political Turmoil. Anthony Bogues, Asa Mesk Professor of Humanities and Critical Theory and Professor of Africana Studies and Director of the Center for the Study of Slavery and Justice at Brown University. He is the author of Empire of Liberty, Power, Freedom, and Desire. And Mark Schuller, Professor of Anthropology and Nonprofit and NGO Studies at Northern Illinois University. He is the author of Humanitarian Aftershocks in Haiti and Killing with Kindness, Haiti, International Aid, and NGOs. Thank you all very much for your insights.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholars Circle team includes Doug Becker, host, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.